Welcome, everyone. I am John Chung. Thank you for listening to my Totally Awesome Films podcast, where I will be discussing some of my favorite movies. For each episode, I pick a movie and discuss my experience watching the movie, and then I research some aspects of how the movie got made and talk about my opinion as to why I think this film is totally awesome. Today, we're going to talk about Live and Let Die, starring a new James Bond named Roger Moore. Now, Roger Moore has a special place in my heart because this was the man who was playing James Bond when I was growing up. And, you know, I'd seen Moonraker in the theaters, but I was a little kid. And of course, a James Bond, a Roger Moore James Bond movie. But it was really For Your Eyes Only that really turned me into a James Bond fan. And of course, I was a teenager, just old enough to really appreciate that this was an excellent movie and this was a franchise worth following. Later, when I became an older teenager, the next James Bond movie I saw again was Octopussy, also starring Roger Moore. And it was really these two movies back-to-back that really got me interested in James Bond as a character, as a movie franchise. And it caused me to go back and watch some of the other James Bond movies, including some of the old Sean Connery films. And, of course, movies that you see as a kid, you know, those will always be some of the most special movies of your life, and that's why I think you know, Roger Moore really, in many ways, is my generation's Bond. I mean, you got to agree, Sean Connery is an incredible superstar, and I can understand his historical impact on the Bond mythos, being the one that helped invent the character. But I personally have to admit that, well, Sean Connery is more my father's Bond. You know, say the name James Bond to anyone in there 40s, and only one name, and really one name alone, automatically pops up in our minds. We really don't think Sean Connery. We certainly don't think George Lazenby. And of course, in many ways, we really don't think Pierce Brosnan. You know, to the millions and millions who grew up in the 70s and 80s, our Bond is Roger Moore. So here's a little bit of trivia. At which James Bond movie did Saltzman and Broccoli consider Roger Moore? So, what do you think? Well, the answer is way back in 1962 with the first James Bond movie, Dr. No. Now, while Roger Moore says he was never officially approached, we now know that Saltzman and Broccoli had been scouting him and were seriously considering putting him in the role of James Bond way before they were even considering Sean Connery. They eventually decided not to because they felt that he looked too young, and the exact quote is he looked too young and too pretty to be James Bond, and they wanted someone a little more macho. And if you want to hear the full story, you can go to the first podcast, the Dr. No podcast, for a longer version of that story. But again, you know, the producers always had their eye on Roger Moore. And again, after You Only Live Twice, when Sean Connery decided that he was going to retire from the character, Eon Productions, Saltzman and Broccoli, actually approached Roger Moore again for the next film, which was going to be The Man with the Golden Gun. They even went to Cambodia and did some test shots. Now, unfortunately, we all historically know what happened in the late 60s in Cambodia with Vietnam. You know, they had a civil war, and as a result, the movie had to be canceled. And then at the same time, Roger Moore accepted a role in a TV series called The Persuaders, you know, where he played a character called Lord Brett Sinclair, opposite legendary actor Tony Curtis. And because of this role, they eventually had to search for someone else, and eventually it went to George Lazenby. Finally, after Diamonds Are Forever, when Sean Connery turned down the next movie, Broccoli and Saltzman now knew who their number one man was going to be. It should be said, though, that Eon Productions actually did offer Connery some money to be in the next movie. They offered Sean Connery $5.5 million to be in the next movie, and Sean Connery wasn't interested. He turned it down. There's actually a whole full Sean Connery story of why he turned down James Bond. And, of course, we now know that he was really trying to become more of a serious actor and depart from his role as James Bond. And he would be very successful at this. I mean, we think of Sean Connery, the actor, now, and he's almost bigger than his role as James Bond. Well, back to the James Bond franchise. Now, United Artists, the movie studio that was distributing the Eon movies, they actually wanted an American in the role of James Bond, and they actually approached Clint Eastwood to be the next James Bond. And Clint Eastwood was hot after, way after the Spaghetti Westerns, but he had just made the Dirty Harry movie, and he was smoking hot. But thankfully, Clint Eastwood also believed that Bond should be British, and he turned down the role. Thankfully, a very classy move on the part of Clint Eastwood. United Artists also asked Eon Productions to consider. Now, when I mention this actor, it's going to seem nuts, but it is true. United Artists wanted Burt Reynolds to be James Bond. And they also asked Eon to consider Paul Newman and Robert Redford as well. But thankfully, the producer, Albert Broccoli, Cubby Broccoli, the head of Eon Productions, insisted that Bond be British. Now, of course, we take this for granted. Of course, they're going to insist that Bond be British. But now keep in mind, Cubby Broccoli is an American. I mean, he grew up in Queens. So if you think in those terms, I think it's pretty cool that, Cubby Broccoli had the integrity toward the character and understood the character's British roots, and having respect to the character and having respect to Ian Fleming's creation, really, really stood to his guns and insisted the character be British. And if you think in those terms, it really is cool of him that he did that. So at the top of the list then was an actor named Michael Billington, who was a British actor. And now if you see him, if you Google his name, he does kind of resemble Daniel Craig. So you can kind of see where maybe which direction they were thinking of going toward. However, Cubby Broccoli really liked Roger Moore and eventually pushed him to be in the role. Although we now know that the producers also kind of kept Michael Billington, in touch with him, just in case Roger Moore didn't work out or backed away or something else. So much so that when it became obvious that Roger Moore would be the next Bond, they still gave Michael Billington a role in The Spy Who Loved Me. And he's actually the Russian agent that gets killed by Bond in the opening teaser. So, anyway, so we basically start the movie, and already the movie is a little different. So we have a new gun barrel sequence, and not only do we not have Bob Simmons' weird little hop, we don't have Connery kind of losing his balance or Lazenby's crouch, we get a sleek new Bond without the bowler hat kind of gliding across the screen and going into just a lightning-fast two-handed shoot. And I really like this. I really like this opening gun barrel sequence. I think it's the best gun barrel sequence, and I think it kind of sets the stage that we are going to have a new modern age of James Bond. So, we meet our new 007 in Roger Moore, and really, he's as handsome as Connery, and maybe even a little prettier, and while he lacks Connery's magnetism, I think he makes up for it in a kind of an aristocratic sophistication. So if Sean Connery is the iconoclastic English rogue, I think Roger Moore can kind of represent the quintessential British gentleman. He is very different, but in many ways he kind of is the same. So, and there's one scene in the opening scene where he's abetting an Italian spy, and he's able to strip a woman's clothes off with his little magnetic wristwatch. And I think in that scene, he kind of wins us over right away. Now with bias, with future knowledge that this is going to be the next Bond, at that moment, I kind of feel like, okay, the franchise is now in good hands. Live and Let Die is directed by Guy Hamilton, who directed Goldfinger and the last film, Diamonds Are Forever. And the movie is kind of an odd hodgepodge of some of Bond's cartoonish villains, some campy action sequences, a ridiculous plot involving a man flooding the drug market by giving everyone free heroin. But the saving grace of this film is that all these ridiculous individual elements are all really good. And even though the sum of the whole may not make much sense or may not be the makings of a great film, all the individual really good scenes kind of adds up to a really good movie. And I really had fun watching this movie, and I hope you did too. The New Orleans locale adds a refreshing change of scenery. There are some pretty interesting characters. Yaphet Kotto, of course, is likably evil as Dr. Kananga. Jeffrey Holder, who anyone my age probably remembers him as the 7-Up commercial guy, the ho-ho-ho-ho guy in all the 7-Up commercials. And this guy is pretty creepy and very, very charismatic as the Baron Samedi. Interestingly enough, Baron Samedi is not an Ian Fleming creation. I looked this up and researched that he actually is a real character in voodoo mythology. He's actually the spirit of death, and sure enough, does have kind of a white skull painted on him, has the same hat. So this actually is a real character in voodoo mythology. The idea being that this character that Jeffrey Holder is playing is actually pretending to be the spirit of death to control the people of that community. So, as you're watching this movie, of course, it's very obvious that the film is borrowing heavily on the popular blaxploitation films of the time. And this is going to be a pattern for some of the James Bond movies, where James Bond is going to borrow from whatever's trendy at the time. Now, I hadn't really done this before, but this is going to be the start of doing that. And in fact, the next movie, The Man with the Golden Gun, is also going to borrow heavy from the Hong Kong martial arts films, which had just become popular a couple years earlier. Just like Moonraker after that is going to borrow from the success of Star Wars. James Bond is always going to be on the cutting edge of copying whatever's on the cutting edge. So we have this blaxploitation movie, and the writer was actually kind of worried about the fact that all the villains were black. So what they decided to do was they decided to make the villains as likable and as interesting as possible, and I do think that they succeed. You know, if you think about the bad guys here, Dr. Kananga, Baron Samedi, Teehee with his mechanical hand, Whisper with the heavyset guy that with the raspy voice. I mean, these are all very interesting, very charismatic characters, and possibly some of the more interesting, most memorable villains in the entire 007 franchise. Another thing that I noticed, and I really noticed it for the first time watching it this time, is that the movie kind of seems to be borrowing from Dr. No. So it's almost like the pattern of Dr. No being an introduction to the Sean Connery Bond. If they're going to introduce a new Bond in Roger Moore, they may as well borrow some motifs from that film. I mean, it starts off with the local assassins killing off agents. You have a larger-than-life villain with plans of world domination, a beautiful Bond girl, femme fatale. Just a lot of patterns, including the introduction of a character named Quarrel Jr., who apparently is supposed to be the son of Quarrel from Dr. No, which seems kind of odd, but when I researched this, I found out there's a little more to it. In Ian Fleming's books, Casino Royale came first, Live and Let Die was actually his second book, and Dr. No was actually his fourth book. So in Live and Let Die is the book where James Bond meets Quarrel. And then, two books later, in Dr. No, it's the same character, Quarrel, that he met in Live and Let Die, only in that book he meets his death at the hands of Dr. No's men. Well, in the movies, it has a little different continuity, so Quarrel has already died. So what they decided to do is introduce a character where they heavily imply that this is a Quarrel's son. Of course, you can't discuss Live and Let Die without discussing Jane Seymour as the just beautiful, beautiful virgin psychic tarot card reading solitaire. I'm watching this now, and I fell in love with her back then, and I'm watching this movie now, and I just couldn't take my eyes off her. She's insanely beautiful, and the screen can't help but just fall in love with her. And, in many ways, if you really think about it, this character is also kind of that helpless damsel in distress. Unfortunately, the saving grace, this character just succeeds based on just the insane beauty of Jane Seymour. Interestingly enough, though, even though While Solitaire is Caucasian in Ian Fleming's original book, the screenwriter Tom Mankiewicz actually wanted to rewrite her as an African-American woman and actually wanted Diana Ross to play her. Now, I really think that would have been very interesting. But the producers ultimately decided that the character should be a Caucasian woman, and they originally considered Catherine Deneuve to be in it, but then eventually ended up casting a relative unknown named Jane Seymour. Again, unknown at the time, this was her first starring role, and even the credits read introducing Jane Seymour. And already at this point, you know, she seems destined for superstardom. And, you know, we now know Jane Seymour is as hundreds of movie parts, and probably her most famous as the role of Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman on television, as well as other roles. There's just something about the way Jane Seymour plays Solitaire that has both this sort of childish innocence, but also kind of a tragic gravitas. And while I like the idea of an African woman as Solitaire, I just can't imagine anyone else besides Jane Seymour in this role. The two main action sequences are also pretty iconic. So the main one being, of course, Bond jumping on the backs of crocodiles and onto a boat across the bayou, you know, kind of like the video game Pitfall. This is actually performed by Ross Kananga. And he's the one, he's a stuntman, and he actually owns the farm, and he actually recommended that James, they have a scene where James Bond jumps on the back of crocodiles, and he actually decided to do the stunt himself. When I first saw this movie, I really wondered how they did this. I assumed it was a special effect. It wasn't. These real crocodiles were used, and Ross Kananga just jumped over the crocodiles. And if you see it, the last crocodile almost bites Ross Kananga's leg. And the footage looks so great, they actually kept it in the film. So you can actually almost see Ross Kananga's leg being being bitten off by the last crocodile. So check that out. Guy Hamilton got the idea of this location when he was location scouting in Jamaica and saw Ross Kananga's farm with a sign that said, "Trespassers will be eaten." And Guy Hamilton was so impressed by that the farm and by the stunt that he actually decided to change the villain's name in the book to Dr. Kananga as an homage to Ross Kananga in doing that stunt. Another famous action sequence is the boat jump scene. And according to the Bond history, 17 boats were actually destroyed during rehearsals. And when they successfully cleared the jump for the shoot, it unintentionally set the Guinness Book of World Records of 110 feet. And apparently that record held for a few years. So when you see that boat clear, that also is not a special effect. That is a Guinness World setting, a boat jump. Another memorable thing about this movie is, in my opinion, one of the stupider, and that's the role of Sheriff Pepper, which is played by character actor Clifton James. And he's kind of that fat, idiot, local Southern cop that gets his comeuppance, you know. I think his character kind of seems kind of stupid and not worthy of being in a Bond film, but it must have been pretty popular at the time because, of course, when you're watching this movie, you see all these cool James Bond elements. What is the one thing you're thinking? Are you thinking, wow, I want to see more of that Sheriff Pepper? Well, sure enough, Sheriff J.W. Pepper will return in the next Bond film, The Man with the Golden Gun, with an even larger part. So, and, you know, if you're watching this movie like I saw this movie and thought that the character was oddly familiar, it's because the actor Clifton James has played this character about 100 times in all sorts of movies and in TV episodes like The Dukes of Hazzard, and even up to recently. But probably the most famous time that he's reprised this role is in 1980, and it's in the movie Superman 2, when the Kryptonian Phantom Zone villains appear on Earth and they're in a small town. And they sort of wreak havoc on this town. That sheriff is also Clifton James, kind of playing the same Sheriff Pepper character. Speaking of returning actors, one actor that's glaringly missing is Desmond Llewellyn as Q. And he was intentionally left out of this movie. And apparently one of the reasons why is they kind of wanted to set a different tone from this movie to intentionally separate it from the past Bond films. Now, apparently this was to Desmond Llewellyn's dismay, because Desmond Llewellyn was actually an actor on a TV series and had already taken off 3 episodes so that he can go film his role as Q in this movie. And to his annoyance, when he arrived on set, the producers told him that he had that he was not going to be in this movie. So he was pretty upset about that, but no matter, he would return in the next movie and would be in all the James Bond movies after that until his retirement in The World Is Not Enough. I also really like the final action sequence of this movie. Spoiler alert, Jane Seymour is captured and kidnapped and tied and is being forced into a sort of voodoo ritual. And James Bond crashes this voodoo ceremony, not in a suit, but in a kind of an odd black outfit with a brown gun holster. I think it's the first and last time he's had this look. But to me at that moment, I mean, he really looks like a superhero. And it's a cool costume right out of a comic book, kind of reminiscent of sort of Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., which ironically is based on Sean Connery's James Bond. But the scene just has everything. It has a beautiful damsel in distress. It has a villain with a face painted like a skull, holding a handful of live snakes, and yes, there's even robots in the scene. So it really does feel like something out of a comic book, but in a good way. And I really think the scene works. It's a great scene. Apparently, Jeffrey Holder was terrified of snakes and did not want to jump into that casket full of snakes. But apparently, on the day of shooting, Princess Margaret was actually visiting the set. She was a James Bond fan and was kind of touring the set. And Jeffrey Holder, being a very loyal British citizen and a fan of the royal family, wanted to impress Princess Margaret and did the shot. And the shot looks great. It's a very terrifying, terrifying scene. So I'm wondering what you thought of the movie and what you thought of this introduction of the new James Bond. Obviously, this movie has a lighter tone that's going to match kind of the tone of Roger Moore. I like it. This movie is generally kind of regarded as one of the middle Bonds. Some people rank it a little higher, some people rank it a little lower. But I think it kind of comfortably rests in the middle. And I agree with that ranking. I think in the middle, kind of more toward some of the better Bonds. The film at the time was a huge breakout success. The movie was made on a modest budget of $7 million, which is less than the budget of Diamonds Are Forever. And the movie made $162 million worldwide. When you adjust that into $213, that's $837 million. This is almost twice what Diamonds Are Forever made. And it is over 3 times what Honor Majesty's Secret Service made. This movie is beloved by fans and by the British audience of the time. And in fact, when it appeared on television, on British television, for the first time in 1980, it to this day still holds the record for the most viewed broadcast film on television in the United Kingdom at 23.5 million viewers. So obviously, we know that the franchise was in good hands. And Roger Moore is just damn good here. He's suave, he's sophisticated, he's got a little bit of dangerousness, a little bit of cruelty, and we're going to see a little more of that even in For Your Eyes Only. He's a very different Bond, but in many ways he's the same Bond. And what's cool is he's got this youthful vitality to the role where we feel like we're seeing a much younger Bond. Ironically, the actor Roger Moore is 2 years older than the actor Sean Connery, and if you consider that this movie was made 2 years after Diamonds Are Forever, Roger Moore was 4 years older than Sean Connery was when he was in his last movie. So you got to give props to Roger Moore for just being youthful beyond his years. I really had fun watching this movie again. Again, I was reminded how beautiful Jane Seymour was. One thing I liked about this movie is it just feels more modern, you know. So there are no more projector screen special effects that kind of plagues earlier films. The stunts are more real. The special effects are better. The cinematography now feels like it's entered the modern age. And of course, even though it's cliche to talk about how great Sean Connery is, and of course, he is great, but us sort of closet Roger Moore fans often feel like we're in the minority. But after watching this film, I feel confident that I could proudly put this film up against any of the Connery Bond films any day. And of course, this is going to eventually lead to two, if not three, of some of my favorite James Bond films, which will include The Spy Who Loved Me, For Your Eyes Only, and Octopussy. And I think those three movies, of course, can go on the shelf head-to-head with any of the best Sean Connery movies from Russia with Love or Goldfinger. So, again, cartoony and campy, this film is saved by excellent actors, fun action, and a new charismatic Bond, my Bond, Roger Moore. For the next week's episode, I'd like you all to watch the next James Bond movie, which is The Man with the Golden Gun. Now, I'm warning you that if you haven't seen this, this, ironically, is considered one of the worst James Bond movies in the entire franchise. So be prepared. There's some good elements, but there are a lot of bad elements. So anyway, please join us next time for The Man with the Golden Gun. In regards to this episode, I really appreciate you listening, and I hope you had a great time. Thank you very much.